Hi, I'm Dr. Robert Pearl, former CEO of the Permanente Medical Group, Kaiser Permanente, a Stanford Medical and Business School professor, a Forbes contributor and best-selling author of the book Mistreated, Why We Think We're Getting Good Healthcare and Why We're Usually Wrong.
And I am Jeremy Corr, host of the New Books in Medicine podcast. American healthcare is broken. Across the United States, there are over 200,000 patient deaths from medical error every year, growing physician burnout, outdated technology, and inconvenient and delayed care for patients. And on top of all of this, skyrocketing drug prices and increasingly unaffordable out-of-pocket patient expenses. For decades, our nation's political and medical leaders have talked about fixing the American healthcare system, and yet the problems are now greater than in the past.
Every other industry that is inefficient and ineffective has experienced disruption. Healthcare will be no different. The question is whether the solutions will come from inside the healthcare system or be imposed on it. We'd like to invite you to listen to our new podcast, Fixing Healthcare with Dr. Robert Pearl and Jeremy Corr. Each episode will feature one of the top leaders and innovative thinkers in healthcare today. The show's format is simple. The guests will present a roadmap for fixing American healthcare's biggest problems. And from there, Jeremy and I will scrutinize the plan and help listeners separate fixes that have the potential to succeed from simply the hype.
Our goal is that everyone from healthcare consumers to political and medical leaders will find value in the discussions on our show. You may not agree with the different solutions offered, but you will never again conclude that nothing can be done. We hope you will join us. Please subscribe via iTunes or your favorite podcast software. For more information, visit our website at www.fixinghealthcarepodcast.com.
Hi, everyone. This is Mikey McGovern, and you're listening to New Books in Medicine. I'm here today with Jim McEwen, professor of classics at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, to discuss his new book, A Cabinet of Ancient Medical Curiosities, published this year by Oxford University Press. Jim, welcome to New Books in Medicine.
Thank you for having me.
So we like to get things started here by talking about your career trajectory and how it is that in your previous work you were led to the kinds of questions and concerns and the approach that you have taken in this really interesting collection.
Oh, well, that's an easy question, really, in as much as it was kind of a natural growth. I have an overall ambition to read all the Greek and Latin texts that survive from antiquity and right up through pagan, the pagan cultures. And a large part of that does have to do with medicine. But the book itself started as an outgrowth of a course I was teaching on the Greek and Latin origins of medical terminology. Not being myself a doctor, although I could explain quite confidently why some big long word was the word it was, I hadn't really got too much of an idea of how it fitted into medical culture. So it gave me a way of, as it were, to use a medical image, sugaring the pill a bit by giving students some sort of idea of the cultural background. I tended to go for the order aspects simply because that does tend to catch a student's interest and imagination rather better. It tends to be the thing they'll remember.
And what would you say, do you think that the intended audience of this book is largely students, largely for just intrigue, medical practitioners? How would you characterize it?
The book is intended to entertain anyone who reads it, but more than just entertain them, to give them some sort of idea of what ancient culture was like, because medicine is one of the most basic things in society. And so you keep hearing about rich people, slaves, women, foreigners, religious ideas and superstition that might go along with that. So many aspects of culture that there's something for everyone in that, even if it's not that I suppose the best thing would be to provoke some sort of thinking about some snippet of information that we have from antiquity that might seem peculiar in some sort of a way.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So in a way, it's giving a kind of a set of points of departure, right? Painting a picture of the various aspects of the culture through, as you say, kind of the odder and more entertaining parts to then sort of, you know, build toward. I mean, this is getting at this distinction that we were just chatting about between the particular and the general, right? So it's really about like assimilating this collection of particulars rather than trying to derive some sort of general principles about culture and antiquity.
That's most emphatically correct. The book consists largely of just my translations of things that people said, either about doctors or things that doctors said. And they are, as long as there's enough context or the context can be inferred, I don't say anything more than that, and I leave it to the reader. I have no grand theory to propound here. It's more or less meant to be no more than illustrative of the society that it comes from. And when I say society, of course, I don't think anybody could write a book in a couple of hundred pages that would cover the whole period, because we're talking about, say, 800 years BC all the way up to about 1000 AD, and that would be a bit too much to cover. But I have picked out bits here and there which don't give a coherent historical context, but do, I think, they're gathered more for the subject matter, which might be, you might get two snippets of information which were 1500 years apart.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you make a claim in the beginning that, you know, this approach is justified because there is a lot going on, but there's not quite so much as sort of big change over time narrative that is interesting to you. Yeah, yeah.
That's a fundamental idea. Nowadays, of course, medicine is, well, there just about isn't a discipline that's more forward-looking than medicine, if you can just consider the last couple of decades. But in antiquity, there was a great reverence for the past, so that, for example, Hippocrates, he comes in about 400 BC. He is revered by Galen in the second century AD. Well, that's what, 600 years later. And if Galen thinks there's anything else, if anybody says something else, Galen tests it against what Hippocrates had said. Well, that would be inconceivable nowadays when nobody looks back 600 years now. And having said that, Galen himself became the monument of classical medicine, and he was revered for 1,000 years after that. So it was conservatism of a very high order that one finds in ancient medicine, which for my purposes is very nice, in as much as I don't have to contextualize so much, because what someone says in the 4th century BC might as easily be said by somebody in the 4th century AD.
Mm-hmm. Great. Well, that's really interesting for overall broader framing. And just one more question on that. So a lot of these, as you say, these are works and snippets that haven't been translated fully before. So are all of the quotations in the book, are they all your own translations?
I almost all of them. There are some that actually partly enjoy the challenge of doing it. Some of these medical texts were very hard to read till you got into them. But once you could, they were, it was quite technical stuff. But some I couldn't have access to because I was reliant on translations already in English, or maybe more prominently German, of texts which we don't have anymore in Greek or Latin, but which survive only in Arabic. And for those, I was very grateful to take what was available. And not all ancient texts are now available in any form, but I was very glad to take what I could get from the scholars who are working on that aspect of, you know, the later aspect of medicine. And I will say, scholarship nowadays on ancient medicine is enviably high in its quality. Mm-hmm. So I'm perfectly happy to take translations from such great scholars.
Excellent. Well, so I think that that's enough for us to kind of dive into the material. One of the things that I found most interesting was the way in which class comes up a lot in the different snippets. I mean, there's a way so you have the snippet on page 15 in which Alexander of Tralles claims that rich patients will refuse medical treatments because they prefer magic amulets. So I'm wondering, can you give us a sense of some of the class discussion that's going on in these texts?
You've put your finger on it exactly. This was an ongoing problem here. Most doctors were of rather low status in society, so they didn't have the authority that people nowadays will give them. I mean, of course, we do automatically what our doctors tell us, but in antiquity, not so much. I mean, a doctor might himself be a slave, or he might be someone who had been a slave and was he's in the recognized social category of freedman, someone who had an obligation to his former master. Well, if he wanted to give him some effective treatment that was painful or even inconvenient, he had very little pressure that he could bring to bear on his patient, and the patient could just dismiss him out of hand, or, as we hear would happen, get another doctor's opinion. And we're always hearing about trade rivalry among doctors, competition for the rich pickings in some cases that were available by having rich clients, rich patients. But you can see that had a very detrimental effect on the reputation that doctors might have in antiquity. But more specifically on your question, one does have to deal with this idea that doctors could be they could be a much lower class than their patients. And those, by the way, are the patients we hear about. We don't hear very much about poor people getting treatment at all. Poor people, and we have to think about the antiquity as being, as it were, third world status. Most people were struggling to survive. They simply couldn't stop work for the luxury of medical treatment. What they did, it had to be, you know, a quick fix. They would get back to work and be cured, or we're told, or they would simply die, and that would be the end of that for them. But medicine is very much an elitist thing in terms of what we hear. That's not to say that doctors weren't idealistic and didn't treat patients free or for very little, but by and large, that's not what we happen to hear about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you have examples throughout of kind of this various invocations of a moral code. Sometimes mm-hmm. this Hippocratic oath that is still sort of in a truncated version, right, taken up in medical practice today. But there's this compunction throughout to not be beholden to profit and to try as much mm-hmm. as possible to serve the yeah. poor. But the picture that you give is much more complex. It's that doctors are not this high status profession that we see today. So the meaning of that compunction is just so much different.
Yeah. Actually, if I can take up what you said about the Hippocratic Code, the one naturally thinks of the Hippocratic Code as being something that goes back to Hippocrates and was a code of conduct observed by doctors throughout antiquity. That's not the case. First of all, Hippocrates is a very shadowy figure. We've got about 70 treatises that are attributed to him, and it is possible that he wrote some of them, but it's equally possible he wrote none of them, and he certainly did not write all of them, because some of them have the principles laid down in one treatise contradict what you get in another, and so you couldn't have had it from the same person. It's just attraction to a big name. But so Hippocrates was just one great doctor, but there were other medical sects which were rivals to him, and we don't hear much. We don't hear as much about them, because Hippocrates had the great boast of being the hero of Galen when he came along. So Hippocrates lasted, but not the Hippocrates oath was not a universal thing. And by the way, you may have noticed we're talking here about Greeks. In antiquity, if you wanted to be a doctor, you either were a Greek or you said you were a Greek, because being a Greek was kudos. It helped your reputation, because Greeks were regarded as the people who knew about medicine. The Romans, when they went to doctors, they kind of expected to have Greek expertise that they themselves didn't have.
That's really interesting. And going back to your discussion of Galen, and this actually harkens back to an earlier point in our discussion about the continuity of the Galenic tradition. There's this thesis, now largely debunked, I think, by historians of medicine in multiple ways, that the modernization of medicine was predicated upon physicians going in and dissecting and opening up bodies, and that this was, you know, the thing that led to the transformations of Western medicine. So there are many ways of poking holes in this, but I'm wondering about dissection in medical culture in antiquity, its prohibitions, what was acceptable to be dissected or not.
Yeah.
Galen has those very famous experiments with the bladders of, I think, is it frogs or?
Pigs, I think,
yes.
Because pigs, you can stop them squealing by cutting their whatever it is they squeal with, and then you tie them together again and they'll start squealing again. And he said, use pigs for this experiment because they make the most noise. That's, by the way, but to your rather larger point about dissection. Now that is a point. It's of great significance. It was forbidden for religious reasons, not quite known why, to perform human dissection. You could dissect anything else you liked, but and this is a bit shadowy. It is believed that for about a generation after the foundation of Alexandria in Egypt, during the 3rd century, this would have happened. Dissection of humans and anatomical studies in general thrived there, but then for whatever reason, again, they were stopped and didn't start up again. And doctors say later on that how ignorant they are about the internal workings of the human body. They say, we know as much about the stars in the sky as we do about our insides, because we can't see them. Now, there's a bit of an exaggeration here, because take Galen himself. He started his medical career as the doctor for the arena in Pergamum, His job was to patch up gladiators. So he must have seen the insides of a fair few people. And we're told that anybody who wants to know about anatomy should go on campaign with a mercenary army, because a mercenary army is likely to be in battle, and then they're going to see a lot of, blood and guts. So they weren't entirely ignorant about it, but the things they didn't know really until, in the long view, until practically yesterday, are they're amazing. Medicine has been transformed. I mean, they didn't know, they nearly found out, but they didn't know about the circulation of the blood. This is kind of one of those things about anatomy. When you look at an empty body and you see there's nothing in the arteries, when you see a dead body and there's nothing in the arteries, you have to say, well, what's this for? Mm-hmm. Well, there were various ideas. One was it was the way the soul went round the body. One was that it's how breath went round the body, but not blood. Blood was in the veins. So that was a different thing. Sometimes they didn't distinguish veins and arteries in their terminology even. But and as I say, lots of other things. Until you find out about cells, anything involving a microscope or, shall we say, infection, then you're kind of that limits what you can do. That was really the middle of the 19th century. I mean, people, they still said to the start of the 20th century, your chances of survival if you were taken into a hospital were not as good as they might be, simply because of not yet understanding enough about infection. Mm-hmm. And they never got a grasp of that at all in antiquity.
Mm-hmm. And bringing up the hospital sort of leads me to another question that is perhaps like a subtext of the book, but what were the spaces of medical practice that were available? Was this usually a private phenomenon? Were there kind of public spaces where physicians could be sought out?
The usual thing, we know that there were doctors did have surgeries, patients could go there. That did happen, but if you were poor, you couldn't afford any doctor, and if you were rich, you could afford all the doctors you would like, because the disparity between rich and poor was tremendous, and you would be more likely to call in a doctor or several doctors if you were rich, and they would come to you, as would anybody of a lower class who was bringing you services of any sort. Not you going to them. And the upshot was there really weren't any hospitals as we would understand them, except those gradually arose with the Roman army, because obviously soldiers were wounded, needed treatment of whatever sort. And so they, and also the Romans were in fairly stable in where they would be. They weren't marching and invading places all the time. So they could have small, or in some cases, bigger institutions, which we would recognize as hospitals, but not really. It was very much a private thing. And a consequence of that is there was very little interchange between doctors. They didn't have case notes, which they passed on, as it were, because they were very much acting on their own. And that applied. If several of them were called in to a rich patient, they wanted to be the one who stood out and whose ideas for treatment were favoured. They were likely not to want to pass on their ideas to their colleagues. I mean, we hear about I think it's Galen. If it isn't, it might as well be. Galen saying that was they're standing round a patient's bed, mustn't bicker and disagree with each other and try to outdo one another with their ideas, which shows you something. It shows you that that is exactly what they did do. And that's hardly the way things are nowadays.
Jim, so I understand that you had prepared a couple of passages on subjects that were interesting for you. So I'm wondering if we could maybe start by talking about theories of mental health. One thing that was interesting that I observed in the book is there is a somewhat stark division between physical causation and mental causation. And there's even a quote, I think, where it was Plutarch who was designating that there's this tendency for some doctors to overdiagnose, and in a way, including mental illness within that medical ontology was sort of a way of doing that. So could you give us a sense of some of the material that deals with how people thought about mental illness in antiquity?
Well, maybe if we could start off by talking about the purpose of the brain, just to show you how off-center they were. In antiquity, it wasn't clear which part of the body ruled the others. And of course, that's the question that we wouldn't maybe pose that way. But the three candidates were the stomach, because if you starve the stomach, all the other parts will wither and die. But the two that maybe had a more philosophical level were considered were the heart, and the other was the brain. But to some people, it was the heart, because the word for heart is cardia. Now, this will sound daft, but this is from Stoic philosophy, and they like this sort of what we would call simple wordplay, but they would make deductions from it. The word for heart is cardia. Yes, everybody knows. And if you, there was a another dialect form of it, not cardia, but cradia. And if you change the D sound in that word to a T sound, you get cratia. And cratia, as in words like democratia, democracy, means rule by the people. Therefore, by its very name, it must be the heart that rules the body. Now, that probably doesn't feature in medical textbooks nowadays, but once you've determined that the heart is the center of things, which is quite an achievement when you don't understand about the circulation of blood, you're going quite far to get that. But then you have to demote the brain, and to some people, the brain was just an empty mass of tissue with no particular purpose. It wasn't the only part of the body that was dismissed in that sort of way as being really just something to make up the numbers within the body. The spleen, of course, nothing was understood about the spleen, and the word spleen was etymologized again wrongly to mean something which supplements the body to stop the various organs, the other various organs which do have a purpose, from bashing into each other. It was kind of just bubble wrap, as it were, with no purpose. But anyway, now, on medical illness, there was treatment for it, but of a very primitive type, simply because they didn't understand about it. And here's a quotation from the 2nd century AD from Plutarch. He says, whenever a doctor went to visit a patient and found him lying in bed, groaning and refusing food, if he then examined him and determined that he was not of a fever, he said, mental illness, and went away. Now, there's quite a lot you could get out of that. First of all, the idea that there's no way of helping the patient because he has mental illness. And the other thing is, why doesn't the doctor at least try? And the reason why a doctor would be tempted not even to try is that to have a failure amongst your patients, someone whom you tried to treat but were unsuccessful in doing so, this would affect your reputation. And your reputation by word of mouth was crucial, because you didn't have a various showing your that you had graduated from such and such a qualifying institution. In fact, it's even suggested, and not facetiously, that all a doctor has to do to be a doctor is to put out a sign saying he's a doctor, and if he really wants to attract patients, he should say that he was trained in Alexandria. Nobody's going to be able to disprove this, and it sounds good. So, as you can see, that would be an absolute nightmare for us today. We wouldn't have that. But not wanting to teach to treat mental illness and various other types of illness was that was just part of the way doctors were. There were limitations to what they could do, and they were pretty canny and shrewd about trying to experiment. It's another aspect of this conservatism that you get in ancient medicine, indeed ancient life generally.
Mm-hmm. And amidst all this conservatism, sorry? I'm interested also, what role did superstition play in all of this?
Superstition is... I should say at least once very assertively that ancient medicine, as it appears in my book, because the purpose is really for entertainment and to provoke thought that way, we wouldn't be where we are without it. There were lots of great doctors who were very intelligent and practical in what they were doing, but they were also pretty... they were always coming up against the weight of superstition that people thought that something would be effective, and they weren't interested in something otherwise. But let me read you one passage. I won't say yet who wrote it, but this is for relief from tonsillitis. And take several threads, preferably dyed with sea purple. Put them round the throat of a viper and choke it. Then tie all the threads round your own neck, presumably with the viper now dead but still hanging on it. This amulet gives amazing relief from tonsillitis and any growths in the region of the neck. And that... wonderful bit of advice comes from Galen. He wrote. He's by far the most voluminous writer surviving from antiquity. So you're always going to find some things in him that you might be amazed at. But that sort of thing recurs. I mean, he has a certain respect for astrology in a way in which we wouldn't, take an astrology as a kind of superstition. The conjunction of the planets will produce this and this effect and that effect. And he says, I have taken careful note of this for my own health, and I have observed that the astrologers are correct. And so if he can be like that, what's it like at the other end of the spectrum, where you get medicine from people who have no resources, no education? It'll obviously be there'll be a lot more of it. And of course, this is not—it's not all bad. I mean, the placebo effect of some of this could be helpful, but that's all it was. And I emphasise, we do have doctors who are rather more objective, rather more practical than what would appear in the more eccentric cures and diagnoses that I talk about. I mean, there's a wonderful chap. If I were sick in antiquity, the chap I would want to go to is a chap called Sorenus in the 2nd century AD. There's only one work from him surviving. It's on gynecology, but he obviously was really practical. He comes straight out and says, amulets are no use whatsoever. And you do get people like that, but they would seem to be in the minority. And why is he saying it? Modern doctors don't say, don't bother wearing an amulet, because there isn't enough pressure to suppose that that's the case. Can I say a bit about women? Women,
yeah, absolutely.
Both as doctors and patients. Kind of hidebound way that ancient society worked, stratified according to the status and wealth and what have you. It spilled over also into the status and the role of women. And if I can say something about women as patients to start with, gynecology was not very well developed, as were women's diseases that are specific to women in general. If I can just read a passage from a late doctor called Aretaeus, he's talking about a phenomenon called the wandering womb. No, it is, believes in the wandering womb. The womb is where it is, and it stays there. But the inside workings of the body, the internal workings, you might think that the womb could wander about, and so they did for thousands of years. They thought this. Here is a comment on hysterical suffocation, and hysterical means caused by the womb. He says, the womb is an organ found in women. It lies between a woman's sides and is very like a living creature in that it moves of its own volition to both the right and left side. It can move upwards to the floating ribs or laterally towards the liver or the spleen. It can also move straight down. The womb is altogether erratic. It enjoys pleasant smells and rushes towards them, but is bothered by foul smells and tries to avoid them. A woman's womb is generally like an animal within an animal. And, building on that statement there, the way to cure the wandering womb was if a woman was being suffocated, this hysterical suffocation, the thing to do was to give her sweet things to breathe in through her, sweet smells to breathe in through her nose. Nasty smells to breathe through her nose, but to light a fire with sweet wood, sweet smelling wood and or what have you, and get her to sit over it, so that the fumes would go upwards through her body and that would attract her womb downwards. Okay, so there's one fairly, that was a more or less universally believed idea, something that's to us obviously quite impossible, but it was, that stayed for a very long time. There were other things like the, about how little doctors who were mostly men understood about women. For example, we're told confidently, no woman is ambidextrous. The first time I saw this, I had a class of about 25 students, 15 women, and a bit of the rest were men. And I had no men who were ambidextrous, but in that class, I had one girl who could write out a line of Greek poetry with her right hand, then she wrote it out with her left. And there was another girl who wrote the same line simultaneously with her right and left hand. Now, the point of that is how little practical observation comes into that. Or lack of interest in what was there for all to see. But to actually make the positive statement, no woman is ambidextrous, seems to me, it shows that women were not high priority in the profession. There are plenty of texts writing numbness, and gynecology certainly does feature. But gynecology was something that was mostly done by women. We do hear about women doctors, and in the last 20 years, a lot of work has been done on this, and we can see that they weren't as marginalized as was always thought. You wouldn't see it by just reading the text, but there are other things like inscriptions, dedications, which show this. If I could read you a funeral, an epitaph for a woman doctor set up by her husband, I think it sort of puts it puts women in context in this regard, you know, the ambivalence about them being, as were, second class citizens or doubtful as doctors. Here it is. This epigram, it comes from Pergamum, which the heartland of medicine for a long time. That's where Galen came from. It's by a doctor, and it's honoring his wife, who is also a doctor. He says, "Farewell, my wife Panthea, from your husband, whose grief at your devastating death is inconsolable. Hera, the goddess of marriage, has never before beheld such a wife, excelling in beauty, wisdom, and discretion. All the children you bore resemble me, and you took care of your husband and your children. You kept the tiller of our domestic life on a straight course, and you exalted our shared reputation as doctors. Nor, even though you are a woman, did you fall short of me in skill." Now, if I were Panthea, I would be a wee bit offended about the last sentence there. He was going quite well until he came to that. But then he said, and it's unambiguous, a concessive clause there, "although you are a woman." In other words, the implication being that women were not expected to match men in this regard, or it was a bit of a surprise. But now, so I'm persuaded by what people have been saying over the last 20 years about women not being marginalized as doctors as much as we thought. I mean, it was part of modern prejudice as well, that, but there is one lingering thought that recurs to me, and that is, here's Panthea. She's a doctor. As far as we know, she's a general practitioner, as we would say. And I would just wonder, knowing the attitudes of Greeks in antiquity and in lots of societies until, and probably including nowadays, I would wonder how many men would want to be treated by a woman doctor. I mean, it's the sort of thing where you would expect, if it happened a lot, you would expect to hear about it as being unusual. But we don't, that's one thing we don't actually hear about so-and-so, the woman doctor, being called in or having a success that men didn't or what have you. So I think our picture there, as in so many other ways, is just a bit incomplete.
And it's interesting with the question of like the written record, right? Because when you have historical sources that are all kind of written down by men with their, you know, historical prejudices of the time, it's hard to really figure out what that sort of sphere of expertise would look like. So it's interesting. Yeah, it seems like there is a lot of space for interpretation, but as you've looked through these medical writings, have you found that many women authors?
Actual authors there are practically none. It's more that they're talked about than that they survive. But having said that, when you consider the number of doctors, of whether men or women, there were through what, 1500 years or so, there are very few of them that have survived. The medical texts they're very rich and abundant, but the number of doctors, of male doctors even, is not that great. I mean, if you took away Galen and Hippocrates, you would you wouldn't have that much left. But I'm afraid it would be wonderful to have a few case studies from a woman doctor, but well, we don't have those.
That's fascinating. So as we're kind of wrapping up here, I'm just wondering if you could let our listeners know what next after this work. What kind of current project are you working on? Is it another translation, compendium type thing? Yeah, we'd love to hear about it.
Oh, well, what I'm working on now is, I'm not quite sure what the presentation will be, but I'm working on Greek and Roman law, which is a completely different thing from Greek and Roman medicine, because Greek and Roman medicine was a continuum. Greek law is, we have over 100 speeches, and we have obviously a lot of opinions about law courts and what have you. In Rome, we have, apart from Cicero in the first century BC, and he's voluminous, we have no speeches, but we do have vast amounts of jurisprudence, which became the basis for what we have in many European and the American system nowadays. But those, unlike medicine, they can't neatly be put together. They're too, the nature of the evidence just makes them completely separate. It's quite good fun, that, seeing particularly the Greek side of things, seeing how different courts were then from ours. They didn't have judges. They just had a jury who listened to the defendant and the accuser, and then without conferring, they just gave their verdict. But it wasn't, as it were, 12 good men and true. The courts, the juries consisted of at least 201. It had to be an odd number because of to make sure there were no draws. 201, and it could go up to 6,000. So it was like being in the theatre, and certain, shall we say, for someone like myself who's as interested in the scurrilous side of things as in the, shall we say, the more serious side, it leaves plenty of scope for anecdotes of one sort or another.
Great. Well, that sounds fascinating. So, Jim, thank you so much for your time with us today. And to our listeners,
you're very welcome.
Oh, of course. And to our listeners, thank you so much for tuning in. This has been New Books in Medicine. And remember, A Cabinet of Ancient Medical Curiosities is available through Oxford University Press. Thanks so much.